Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode focuses on energy policy under the Trump administration and assesses the ramification of potential policy choices ahead. In this hour, we're going to hear from Severin Borenstein. He's a professor of business administration and public policy at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. We'll also hear from Hal Harvey, and he's the CEO of Energy Innovation, Policy and Technology. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience, and this broadcast is made possible by the generous support of Chevron. And now to our moderator, Dan Adler, who's Vice President of Policy at the Energy Foundation.
Good evening. It's my great pleasure to introduce tonight's guests. Hal Harvey is the CEO of Energy Innovation, a San Francisco-based energy and environmental policy firm. Previously, Hal was the founder and CEO of ClimateWorks Foundation, the Environment Program Director at the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and founder and president of the Energy Foundation. Hal also served on energy panels appointed by Presidents Bush and Clinton, and last year, Hal was honored with the 21st Heinz Award in the environment category. He is also a senior fellow for energy and the environment at the Paulson Institute. Severin Borenstein is the E.T. Grether Professor of Business Administration and Public Policy at the Haas School of Business and a research associate at Haas's Energy Institute and the National Bureau of Economic Research. He's also Director Emeritus of the University of California Energy Institute and the Energy Institute at Haas. He has served on the board of the California Power Exchange, the California Attorney General's Gasoline Price Task Force, and California's Emissions Market Advisory Committee, and currently chairs the Energy Commission's Petroleum Market Advisory Committee. Thinking back to where we've been in recent memory, in December of 2015, the world gathered in Paris under the auspices of the United Nations to negotiate the Paris Accord on climate change. The agreement the world reached, 195 nations, was undoubtedly a turning point in humanity's approach to this global threat. And I think of equal importance, it marked a globalist moment when the world created a framework to address common problems above and beyond climate change. It was a tremendously hopeful moment for the world, not just in climate and energy. Less than 1 year later, we elected a U.S. president on a platform expressly disavowing all those themes, not just clean energy and climate, but international cooperation and globalism at its core, threatening to withdraw the United States from the Paris Accord, scuttling the EPA's Clean Power Plan, which was the centerpiece of the U.S. contribution to that effort. Almost immediately, California's leadership, in the form of Governor Brown, but not just Governor Brown, stepped into this breach to declare unwavering support for the clean energy transition and to address the threat of climate change. As a Californian, that felt good, but more importantly, given California's economy and propensity for innovation and its status on the world stage, it can certainly make a difference, assuming we have the time left to make a difference. I would say the question before us tonight and in the years ahead is how much of a difference can California make? How can California's vision of economic progress utilizing sustainable energy be propagated across the country? And meanwhile, how bad is it likely to get in Washington before we have a chance to change course? To borrow from the candid language of tonight's program, are our children doomed to live in a world destroyed by climate change, or is there still hope? So no pressure, gentlemen, but I'm hoping you can guide us through this thickets. And there are not two people better positioned in the world to help us address that question and follow an arc of a conversation that hopefully lands in a somewhat optimistic place at the end of this hour. But starting with the international frame, where the world was a year ago, where it is now, what that means for all the nations of the world as we struggle collectively and individually to address this problem, how the U.S. is approaching it now, what the prospects for meaningful action are going to look like in the near term, and then down to California, which, as ever, is a leading light and a point of both hope, but also practical solutions. From the end, a pragmatic, proactive, hopefully positive agenda can be identified that we can all take with us out into the night. So to Hal and Severin, if you would set the stage for us, what was the Paris process all about? How did the international community come together, and what was the trajectory that we were on as a nation and as a global community before the election?
Well, I'll jump in. Thank you, Dan. It's important to understand some of the dimensions of the climate change problem. It is most profoundly a tragedy of the commons, the atmosphere shared by everybody. A ton of carbon dioxide emitted in the United States does the same thing as one emitted in Beijing or Marrakesh or anywhere else. So in order to land at a reasonable climate future, we need a carbon dioxide reduction strategy that encompasses most of the big countries in the world. There are about 20 countries together create about 80% of global carbon emissions. It's devilishly hard to build an international agreement that gets 195 nations to do something. Fortunately, we don't have to get 195 nations to do something because there is a mathematical triage at work here. The big countries matter more than the little countries for obvious reasons. Paris was an interesting moment because the previous to Paris, the UN talks had been about burden sharing. How much burden should the US carry in order to decarbonize, since we historically have emitted the most? Or how much should China carry, since it currently emits the most? Or what about the historical emissions of Europe? In Paris, the dynamic switched, and it was a fantastic and positive switch, but it had some limitations. Instead of a narrative of burdens, it was a narrative of opportunities. So the Paris Agreement is structured where every nation brings to the table its own commitments, drafted by themselves, not legally binding, to reduce CO2 emissions. It was kicked off about 6 months before the agreement with a bilateral agreement between the US and China that changed everything, because the US and China are by far the biggest carbon emitters. They got together and they each outlined very aggressive national goals. They presented them to the world, and it made the dynamic a race to the top instead of a race to the bottom. So we walk away from Paris with, as you say, 195 nations signing an agreement, each of which is memorialized in their own domestic commitments to reduce CO2 emissions. They're not legally binding. They're not uniform. They don't add up to a specific target, even though there is a target espoused again and again of 2 degrees centigrade, or even better, 1.5 degrees centigrade change. But what it did is it created very significant momentum in a lot of countries, emphatically in China, maybe most important, in Europe as well, in the United States. So in the big emissions nations, in India, not in Russia. Here's what it didn't do. It didn't produce the detailed strategies to achieve those goals. It didn't produce any legally binding agreement to achieve those goals. So it's susceptible to one-by-one national determination to do what they say they intend to do. It's both the strength and the weakness of this approach.
Severin.
So I think we need to start out actually going to the question, are our children doomed? And I think that, unfortunately, this keeps coming up as a, have we gone over some cliff? And while we may, after the fact, learn that there was a point where we saw substantially more change, we have no idea if there is or not. And I think every year, we've already emitted enough greenhouse gases that we are going to have significant climate change. What we can do in the going forward is going to have very little effect in the next couple of decades. And so we are going to have a significant climate change. On the other hand, we don't know how significant it is, and there is a tremendous ability for the human race to adapt and to help other species adapt. So the giving up idea, because we may have already gone too far, I think is a narrative we really need to reject. I think Hal did a great job of summarizing sort of how we got to Paris and what happened at Paris. I think there's one more piece that's important to remember, which is we got to Paris when we got to Paris because of technology. That is, countries were willing to step up and say, we're going to do something, because Paris occurred at a time after 8 years of tremendous technological change in renewable energy that had really suddenly made it seem feasible that we're going to be able to have a prosperous world going forward using renewable energy. If you had gone back a decade and asked, you know, what are the costs of renewables and what are they likely to be 10 years out, very, very few people, they're always extreme optimists, but very few people would have said that we were going to get solar and wind costs down to the level, and battery technology improvements down to the level that has occurred over the last 5-8 years. That is a big part, I think, of why countries were willing to start stepping up and saying, we're going to do something, because they started to see a path that at least looked like it wasn't a huge burden to move towards renewable energy. And I think they certainly, we certainly aren't there. Fossil fuels are cheap. We have to always remember the other piece of the story over the last decade, which is fossil fuels got a lot cheaper because the technology for extracting fossil fuels got a lot better. And there's still a lot of money to be made figuring out how to make fossil fuels cheap. And that's going to continue to occur too. But we did make tremendous progress in renewables. And I think that's a big part of why countries going forward are willing to step up. Now, the United States, we are now in a situation where we have a leader who doesn't believe that and thinks that we need to push fossil fuels even harder. Coal is not coming back. Coal jobs particularly are not coming back. If you look at the decline in employment in coal, it has nothing to do with environmental changes. It has to do with mechanization. And coal is going to have a very hard time competing because while there are these new technologies, fracking for oil and natural gas, we haven't seen that sort of decline in coal prices and in coal costs. And so it's been the real technological loser over the last decade as well. But it's going to be a big challenge. We need a lot more progress. And the good news is I think most of the rest of the world recognizes that. The majority of Americans recognize that. And there's going to continue to be a push to move forward and get the technologies that'll get us there.
Where's the rest of the world now? Coming out of Paris, each nation had its own determined contribution and its own domestic politics and economics to wrestle with. What's your sense, gentlemen, of where the international community is in relation to the Trump election and whether this has weakened their individual commitments to following through on this course?
So I landed in Marrakesh, which was the follow-up to Paris 1 year later. And it was just a few days after Trump was elected. And you could have anticipated despair, and I was kind of tiptoeing around wishing I had a Canadian flag. But in fact, the reaction was exactly the opposite. Everyone there said, this redoubles our commitment. We are not going to slow down. We are not going to let this perturbation affect our trajectory. I've spent a lot of the last 15 years in China, made at least 50 trips there working with them on now over 100 different energy policies and standards. And they're absolutely resolute in picking up the mantle of leadership if necessary, and it is necessary. In fact, China has an interesting history with international negotiations. Unlike many countries, they underpromise and overdeliver. So I think China is going to significantly exceed its commitments that it made in Paris. Europe will do very well as well. The Middle Eastern nations are becoming the bastions for solar energy installations now, as well they should. Plenty of sunshine. Canada has required every single province to come up with either a cap and trade program or a carbon tax. Australia oscillates back and forth between good behavior and miserable. So I would say all hope is definitely not lost. And then to Severin's point about the economics of it, the most amusing or interesting transition perhaps was India. India has always maintained it shouldn't have to move to a low carbon economy until it's fulfilled its development goals or at least gotten closer. And so Prime Minister Modi essentially said in Paris, we're going to build a lot of coal, and if you give us a lot of money, we'll build a lot of solar. What he should have said from an economics perspective is, we're going to build a lot of solar, and if you give us a lot of money, we'll build a lot of coal. And in fact, that's exactly what's happening in India. They have spectacular record installations of solar, and they recently said they have enough coal to get through 2027. So there are tailwinds. They're not in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I think that a big part of the momentum is the technology is moving forward, and that we see a continued commitment in part because we see many other countries. First of all, most other countries' leadership recognize the reality of climate change. The United States is very much an outlier on that. And they see the potential for major technological change. I am not as optimistic as Hal, I would bet, at how quickly we'll be able to do that, because I also see the potential for very cheap fossil fuels. And as they remain cheap, I think it will be politically difficult to move away from them. And that, I think, just pushes us for the need for ever stronger technological progress on renewables. Because the simple case that I think brings this out is the price of oil was $120, $140 at one point 10 years ago. It's now around $50. That's mostly because supply grew relative to demand. It's not that it's not a huge drop in demand. It's mostly an increase in supply. If we're going to get off fossil fuels, we really need to cut oil use substantially. If you look at the supply-demand shift that caused that drop from $100 to $50, it was only a few percent. If we actually take 20 or 30% out of the oil market demand, which we're going to have to do more than that, the price of oil is going to plummet. The price of oil is going to be down around $20 a barrel or lower. And so my many students who work on electric vehicles and biofuels, I always tell them that if you want a nice little business that you can make some money at and you can beat $3 a gallon gasoline, you can probably have a transportation business you can make a little money at. If you want to change the world, you're going to have to beat $1 a gallon, because the price of oil, when the price of oil is $20 a barrel or $15 a barrel, the price of gasoline is $1 a gallon, or even with a $100 per ton price of carbon, which I doubt is politically sustainable worldwide, it's under $2 a gallon. So that's where we really have to get to. The good news is renewable energy costs are going way down, and battery costs have come way down. And they got to come down a lot more, but that's the challenge I think we face.
And these are turning out to be large-scale global markets, $300-odd billion a year in clean energy investment distributed all around the globe. So if there is a hope in a Trump era, maybe it is on the basis of, quote, winning these big markets. If it's not an environmental mandate but a business opportunity, perhaps there's light for this particular administration. But
that is the story of renewable energy in West Texas and in Iowa and in a lot of red areas. It's not going in there because it's being driven by environmentalism. It's going in there because West Texas is very windy, and you can produce electricity with wind power in West Texas at a very low cost. And that's the big attraction. And if we can keep pushing that so that there's real business opportunities, I think there's more hope.
Indeed. Let's shift, though, to where we are in the U.S. conversation at the moment. The president has threatened to revisit, if not totally abandon, the Clean Power Plan, and has certainly made appointments and further statements consistent with that vision. At the same time, though, there is a lengthy process for revising these rules, and the Supreme Court has determined that CO2 is a pollutant, and so the federal government has to act. A lot of people are taking comfort in the bureaucratic inertia of the system and how long it will take to unwind it. And some even suspect or want to claim that Trump might not actually hold these opinions as strongly as he suggests. There's a precedent for that. But what's your sense of where the federal conversation is in relation to the Clean Power Plan and any other relevant climate action we might see in the next 4 years?
If you look at Trump's appointees, it's very hard to muster hope for progress. I mean, the man he put in charge of the EPA, Scott Pruitt, is a guy who would take a chainsaw to your furniture if he had a chance, in my opinion. He's as anti-environmental a human being as there is on the planet. And he's in charge of the Environmental Protection Agency. So that's sobering, right? There is some good news, and there's some bad news. Let me start with the bad news. The bad news is it took a Supreme Court ruling. It took a revisitation of interesting sections of the Clean Air Act, and it took the courage of the Obama administration and the EPA, successive EPA administrators, to assert in law, as the Supreme Court affirmed, that the EPA has an obligation to control CO2 emissions. That's the law of the land today, affirmed by the Supreme Court. That's what Scott Pruitt is supposed to do now. So that was an amazing victory. Even if the details of how that happens are just being formed, the Clean Power Plan, fuel efficiency standards for automobiles are the two big steps, and reducing methane leaks from natural gas. Those are the three big steps the Obama administration took. If all we do is stop enforcing those laws for 4 years, it won't be a great loss. If, on the other hand, we shred the legal authority of the EPA to control CO2 emissions, that's an enormous loss. But let me mention one other thing that's really important here. Energy policy in America is carbon policy, and energy policy in America has essentially always been set by states. We have a very federalist system. So states decide your utility investments, whether they land on coal or natural gas or wind or solar or hydro or whatever. States set building codes. States set appliance and equipment standards. California sets fuel efficiency standards for cars and for trucks. If you look across the board at where the locus of decision making is, it's state by state by state. And so the 40% of Americans that live under the California regime, as it were, the California rules for a low carbon future, are pushing ahead even faster and even farther than they were before. So in terms of momentum, I don't think we're going to lose that much. In terms of legal precedent, I'm quite frightened.
Yeah, I would agree on the legal precedent. I don't think the Clean Power Plan has any hope of ever going into effect. I don't think that's a big loss either. I think the Clean Power Plan was sort of cobbled together and it's not even clear it was going to be much of a gain. I was much more hopeful when we were talking about Waxman-Markey about having a cap and trade program or some of the more recently Republican introduced tax on carbon. But I think that we have to step back from that and focus on what can we do for the next 4 years that will make progress so that we are then ready at a point in the future where either we have a Democratic president or we have a Republican president who is more willing, as back in 2008, you might remember, when we had two presidential candidates, both of whom thought climate change was a big problem that we had to address. So it wasn't that long ago that both parties thought that this was something we should be dealing with and be ready to step forward. And I think that the big threat, as Hal said, is undermining the entire legal basis for that, the endangerment finding and the power of the EPA. The fear is, of course, that some of the people, and Pruitt is definitely one of them, know that argument entirely and view their goal as to make sure no matter what happens in November of 2020, that the EPA doesn't have the power or the ability to go back to pursuing environmental goals. And we're going to need some good lawyering to block that and to make sure that in 4 years there is still the ability to step right back in and move forward.
Previewing the California part of the conversation a little bit, so California occupies this unique position by virtue of our attention to our dirty air throughout our recent history of having a waiver, effectively, and being able to set its own standards. And Secretary Pruitt now famously refused to endorse that going forward, which sent probably the most significant shockwaves through the policy community of anything he said in recent months, at least. And do you think that's a real threat? And how should an informed citizenry be prepared to engage on that question?
So the law under which California can set its own standards is the Clean Air Act. And in order to remove that ability, Congress has to change the law. And so the question becomes, if this arises to the front of the political agenda, whether it will rise to a filibuster. Because the Republicans, if they decide on a majority basis to destroy California's right to have strong standards, they certainly have the votes to do it. It would require the Democrats to insist on a filibuster. And I think this is as big as it gets.
Yeah.
You know, this is the time to rise up. So one of the interesting opportunities from my perspective, so Scott Pruitt again and again says he's in favor of states' rights, as long as the state is Oklahoma. The question is he in favor of states' rights if the state is California? And our question should be not just to our Democratic members of Congress, but emphatically to our Republicans. The House Majority Leader is Republican from California. He should be defending our right to clean up our air. His district has, he's got a pretty bad air in his district. So are we really going to, is he going to stand up and strip California of its right to clean up its own air? That's not a good thing to do, no matter what party you're in.
Yeah, and I think that that's exactly the tension, that it's quite clear that the EPA is going to minimize their willingness to do anything on the federal level. The question is whether, and certainly it's not going to be helpful to California. The question is, are they going to do so much damage that 4 years from now that we can't step back into it? Mm-hmm. That actually will require congressional action. I'm actually maybe a bit more optimistic than you are that there are a few Republican senators who actually view themselves as environmentalists and would be willing to fight the possibility of removing California's exemption. But I certainly wouldn't place a bet on it. I just think it's a possibility.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Severin Borenstein, professor of business administration at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley, and Hal Harvey, the CEO of Energy Innovation, Policy and Technology. They're in conversation with Dan Adler, who's vice president of policy at the Energy Foundation. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now back to our moderator, Dan Adler.
Well, to get us into the California conversation, touch on the themes that have come up as people have analyzed what the Clean Power Plan was going to produce. And it gradually became the perceived wisdom that not only was it not ambitious enough, but the clean energy markets and general change in energy was delivering those benefits already. There seems to be this inexorable trend towards lower carbon, if not full decarbonization, set and trained partly by states like California driving leadership. But where are you seeing energy markets transform where we can expect progress independent of what happens in D.C.? And help us see across the country, if you will, outside of the obvious places like California and Massachusetts, where some interesting innovation and market change seems durable.
There's the cheapest electricity supply I think ever installed on planet Earth is now solar systems built in the Middle East and in Mexico. So we do have an economic tailwind now, but I would not go so far as to say the market's going to solve this problem. It won't by any means. It's helpful, but incumbent industries fight back, and they fight back very hard. And the utility structure in general is not as susceptible to market forces as the rest of the economic system. Public utilities commissions set the rules. And utilities have to operate the grid to keep it reliable. And I'm an engineer, and I studied power systems planning. And the way we learned is when the demand goes up, you turn on more power plants. That was pretty much my education. And now if you have renewable energy and you have variable sources and you can wheel energy in from other jurisdictions and maybe you have some batteries and you have natural gas power plants that run only 100 hours a year, you all of a sudden have a very rich set of options to balance out large fractions of renewables. From a physics perspective and from a pure economics perspective, it's very inexpensive to go to a almost all renewables grid. But from an institutional perspective, it requires substantial reorganization, and that implies the potential for substantial delay. So the antidote is simple. The antidote is to insist, as California has, to an ever-climbing fraction of renewable energy. It is now law that the state has to get 50% of its energy from renewable energy sources by 2030. That's only 13 years from now. If you add in existing hydro and nuclear, then that goes up to 65%. We're going to decarbonize this grid in the next two decades significantly. So insist on those goals and then give the utilities a mandate to achieve them affordably and the flexibility to achieve them affordably, and it's not a problem.
I see a bigger problem. I think that renewables have gotten a lot cheaper. There are certain locations where the levelized cost of solar is very, very low, the average cost per kilowatt hour, but solar is not reliable. And you can't run a grid with a solar system without a lot of battery. And when you add all the battery in, it's nowhere near cost effective.
We are so lucky you're not an engineer.
And so the reality is we can't balance the grid yet with purely with solar and wind. We are going to need some sort of backup. And we don't know whether we can get to 80% and run a reliable grid in a cost-effective way. In fact, I think the answer is almost certainly no right now. We don't have the battery technology. I hope it will be by 2030 or De Leon's proposal of 100% by 2045, and that we will have the battery technology by then. But the fact is that when it comes to cost, something as an economist I do know a lot about, we aren't there yet. And it's going to be very challenging. We have decarbonized the grid quite a bit. Unfortunately or fortunately, a lot of that decarbonization has come from switching from coal to gas. That's a good thing. It's better than burning more coal, but it is a technological dead end. We can't keep burning gas. We need to figure out a way to burn little or no gas to run the electric grid. I think the vast majority of people in the electricity sector would say, we're not sure how we can do that yet at the levels, the very high levels of penetration.
Dan, can I push back on our solar Cassandra here? So it's true that the sun goes down at night. It does. The sun is very reliable. It's just not always up. But we know when it comes up and we know when it goes back down, and sometimes it's partly blocked by clouds. But if you're in charge of keeping the grid alive and you have wind that sometimes blows and sometimes doesn't blow, and you have sun that is up and down and sometimes covered with or obscured by clouds, the automatic answer is to think, well, we need more fossil as backup or we need a lot of batteries. And those are both interesting options and sometimes good options. But there are a lot of other options. For example, the wind in Wyoming and Montana is almost perfectly countercorrelated with the wind in California. So a transmission line is a solution. Seattle and San Diego never have the same peak power demand or supply. So hook them together with a transmission line and a good market and let them balance each other out. Offshore wind has radically different performance characteristics than onshore wind. So it's an offset. Hydro is dispatchable. Biomass is dispatchable. Geothermal is dispatchable. A natural gas power plant that runs 300 hours a year or 500 hours a year has a negligible carbon impact, but is vastly cheaper than any battery. So a combination of wheeling power, of using heterogeneous renewable energy sources, of fixing up markets, of using fossil fuel intelligently, in effect of optimizing a system rather than simply turning things on and off. That's the solution. And I think the National Renewable Energy Lab did a study of going to 80% renewables for the whole country by 2050. And they did an hour-by-hour model of the entire U.S. grid and showed that you can do this without significant costs and without impinging on reliability. So that's pretty good.
Well, I think that may be right, but there's actually a lot of disagreement, including with the National Renewable Energy Lab study, and the view that there are a lot of less than perfectly correlated energy sources. There's a lot of dispatchable, low-carbon sources. But we've never actually tried to run a system like that. The transmission lines not only are extremely expensive, but they're very difficult to build. There's a lot of environmental pushback against building transmission lines. A fully integrated national or even continental energy system, Hal's entirely right, would be a much easier system to balance because there's wind blowing somewhere. Unfortunately, and I think one of the worst aspects of California energy policy is we're actually moving in the opposite direction. We're moving towards more rooftop solar. We're moving towards more the idea that you can do this in an isolated way. And that is going to actually set us back. What we need to do is integrate. And we also have to recognize that when we integrate with Wyoming, we're only actually moving forward if we're integrating and Wyoming is producing with wind. If we're leaning on the rest of the Western grid to essentially firm up our power, and they're producing with coal and natural gas, we're not really making as much progress. So I think that we actually agree very much on where we should be going. Hal thinks that it's going to be easier than I am confident. I hope Hal's right. I think that hasn't been proven yet. And I think gas is very likely to remain very cheap. And while, you know, I every utility executive and every fossil executive says, look how much we've done to decarbonize the grid without any cost at all. And that's true, but we just got lucky. It could have gone the other way, and we could. So we just happened to, and that's not going to get us where we need to go. We can't go to 100% natural gas and be where we need to be, even if we wipe out all the coal. We have to get off natural gas now. And I hope Hal's right, but I think we're not sure of that yet. Remember, we need a system that is reliable 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, always delivers enough power, not usually. And so sort of negatively correlated wind in Wyoming and California doesn't do that. You need all of the parts, and you need them all to work together. One of the things that California is doing that I think is one of our great contributions is we're running an experiment.
Yes.
We're pushing the boundaries on renewable energy. We're going to go to 50% renewables plus the solar, plus the nuclear and hydro. So we're going to go to a very high, low carbon portfolio, and we're going to figure out how to make that work. By the way, one of the ways we can make it work, and I hope we won't, it's tempting, is to just lean on the rest of the Western grid and have them produce our carbon for us. That really won't accomplish much as much in reducing carbon, and it also, more importantly, won't teach us as much about how we have to actually run the grid.
And it would seem that the leadership in California has already put a stake in the ground on that point, that a grid expansion that just exports our carbon problem won't fly legislatively, but we'll see. And there are a host of experiments like that across the country. Massachusetts with a 100% renewables bill this week, Minnesota with a 50% renewables bill, Iowa, the hotbed of wind development, mostly because it connects to the mid-continent system. It's a fascinating time to be in a federalist program here, which is one of the great virtues of letting us ignore D.C., at least for a little while. But there's another component that we can't ignore, which is the transportation system. There's obviously tremendous excitement about vehicle electrification. All the major auto manufacturers are investing heavily. States are building infrastructure. But it remains the case, and I'll just put a flag in the Tesla conversation as a firm that formally invested in the company. All the cars that Tesla's ever made are made in 5 days by either VW or Toyota. You know, the big auto majors are producing 10 million cars a year, and Tesla's barely making 100,000. So where are we on the transportation component of this challenge, which is now a larger contributor of greenhouse gases than the power sector?
Transportation's tough. There is no easy substitute for oil. Oil's portable, it's energy dense, it's cheap, and you can use it for all kinds of things. It's stable. Batteries are getting cheaper, but they're not getting a lot lighter, and they're not getting easier to make, and they're more complicated. They're still very complicated and sometimes dangerous chemistry. In my mind, there's no question that the electrification of the transportation systems is the way to go. Cars first. And I'm driving an electric car. In fact, I built my own electric car in 1992 and powered it by solar energy and used it for 5 years, and it was a certified piece of crap. Mm. But it got me to work and back every day, and I now drive a much better electric car that I didn't make. So electric cars, the Chevrolet Bolt is $35,000. Then you get a tax credit. It goes over 200 miles on a charge. You can plug it into the solar panels on your roof or your office, and voila, you've got zero carbon transportation, at least for those functions. What California has to do, and this is a perfect place for the state to be, we have to figure out how to go from a couple percent electric to 10, and then to 20. We have to figure out how to build a charging infrastructure. Do you build it at home? Do you build it at work? Do you build it in the shopping mall? Is it slow charge or fast charge? Whose protocol do you use? Who pays for it? Who owns it? We haven't figured these things out yet. At the same time, we're facing this autonomous car revolution, which some people, in my opinion, blithely think ushers in a utopia. A number of national labs got together and they did a study to see if you have autonomous cars, is there more or less driving? And they said the range is from 50% less to 300% more, right? If I'm going to a meeting in San Francisco, why should I pay $30 to park my car? Why not just send the car around the block 30 times? So it's not automatic. It's not an automatic utopia. There are fantastic opportunities to get it right, but it requires good public policy. So California's role here is to test this out. It's to build a charging infrastructure. How do we deal with apartment blocks? Is there community charging? Do you have solar shade structures that absorb sunshine and charge a car? Is the charge dispatching electricity into the grid to help stabilize it at certain hours of the day? The California Public Utilities Commission has committed $1 billion to vehicle electrification, to build a grid, to build a charging infrastructure. And the state of California has an additional $1 billion from the Volkswagen settlement. So with those money and with our very able state officials, I think we're going to, we'll stumble a little bit, we'll make some errors, but I think we're going to begin to prove this transition.
And I hope Hal's right.
Get a theme here.
I think that as I said before, the challenge on beating oil and gasoline is very difficult. Oil prices at the beginning of 2014 were over $100 a barrel, and people were buying small cars. But oil prices are now about $50, and were about $40. And SUV sales have risen again. SUVs are now more than half of all the personal vehicles being sold again. And those cars are going to be on the road in 2030, the cars that are sold today. So this is very long-lived infrastructure. So even if we get to 10% or 20% by 2025, which would be an amazing progress, that still means that 80% of the new cars going onto the road in California are going to be gasoline vehicles. The good news is they're going to be more efficient gasoline vehicles. They may not be as much more efficient as the CAFE standards that exist right now say they're going to be, because even though the Obama administration and the fading days of the administration said, yeah, this is all working great, we continue to 2025, the mid-course review that was scheduled, the Trump administration is in the process of taking that apart and saying, no, not so fast, of trying to take it apart. There will be a legal dispute. So I think this is the hardest part. Well, this is one of the hard parts. There are other, but certainly transportation, because oil and gasoline are just an amazing, natural, dense source of storing energy that we just haven't come up with a good substitute for. One of my engineering friends told me a way of thinking about this is that a gasoline vehicle filled with 10 gallons of gasoline, a small car, is carrying 70 pounds of fuel when it's full. And when it's almost empty, it's carrying almost no pounds of fuel. The equivalent battery electric car is carrying 500 pounds of batteries when it's full. And when it's almost empty, it's carrying 500 pounds of batteries. And that's the engineering challenge. It's just very difficult to produce something that can carry energy as efficiently as gasoline. I think that's not a reason that we should give up, but a reason that we really need to double down on alternative technologies. At the beginning of the Obama administration, there was a very strong fight between the forces of biofuels and the forces of battery electric. And battery electric won the day at that time. And maybe that's the right answer, but that fight is not over, not with biofuels so much as with hydrogen, which is now going to be coming back as another alternative. So I think that not everyone's as certain as I think Hal has said that we are, that electric vehicles are going to be the solution. We should definitely be pushing on that technology. And I think this is the general theme in California. We should be pushing technology, because although it's going to cost us more in the short run, it's the only way the world is going to get to reducing carbon. And actually, I really believe it will benefit California in the long run, that it will make California the leader in new technologies. That is what the California economy has largely been built on, knowledge, new innovation, and that by pushing forward with these new technologies, even if it means our electric bills or electric prices are a little higher, we will have a stronger California economy in the longer run.
Well, that's a good segue into California, where I do want to head next. In the spirit of doubling down, California tends to double down even if it hasn't seen its cards yet. How would you characterize California's leadership over the recent decades? There's a little bit of a tension between you two as public intellectuals. Hal, you've characterized the situation where California's ability to lead is relatively insulated from the federal conversation, that the core components are in place and will continue to push. Where do you see the frontier of California's innovation? And picking up on a theme that's, I know, dear to Severin, what is exportable? And what do we need to be doing differently to make sure that our experiments aren't confined to, yes, the sixth largest economy in the world, but we're 1% of the greenhouse gas emissions?
So we have three kinds of innovation underway here. One is technology innovation. And California has not been the leader in energy technology innovation, but it's doing a pretty good job nowadays. Historically, that's not been our forte. Second is policy innovation. What kinds of policies really drive change that's cost-effective and that engenders the dynamics of the free market to serve us? And the third is, call it system innovation. which is how do we build this balanced grid? How do we build a charging infrastructure? How do we manage very low carbon emissions? We have absolutely spectacular opportunities to lead in all three realms, and the state is doing a lot of that. California, for example, has, I think, the best building code, almost the best in the world, certainly the best in America. And what makes it so good is it's a simple idea that a lot of policies should have. It has continuous improvement built into it. So it was passed into law when Jerry Brown was the youngest governor in our history. And every 3 years, it automatically gets tightened based on a merit test of how cost effective a better building code would be. So now he's the oldest governor in California's history, and it hasn't had to go back to the legislature. Continuous improvement should be built into policy. Here's a counterexample. When Gerald Ford was president, he signed a law to double the fuel efficiency of cars from 13 miles per gallon to 26. And then we went to sleep as a country for 40 years until Obama doubled it again, right? From literally 26 to 54, two doublings, but with this pause in between. If Gerald Ford had said, this will increase at 3% a year instead of specifying a number, we would have saved over $1 trillion that we sent to countries that don't like us. And we would have kept our auto industry competitive because we were not innovating on engines and transmissions and drivetrains and aerodynamics and auxiliary loads, and our German and our Japanese competitors were. So that's the kind of experimentation and leadership this state can show the world. We need to get to a low-carbon prosperity. If California can't do it, who's gonna? If we don't run this experiment, including the cost of getting some things wrong, who's going to?
I agree that we need to run the experiment. I think the place California has been very aggressive in that, in all sorts of dimensions, in technology, in building codes. I think where California is still coming up short is on evaluation. I think energy efficiency evaluation has not been as careful as it should be. My colleagues at Berkeley, who have been trying to do essentially the equivalent of medical studies, of randomized controlled trials in a number of cases, have found pretty disappointing results. I think California, when in our carbon accounting, really needs much more care than we have engaged in. The California cap and trade program for carbon is built on one set of rules, but those aren't all of the greenhouse gases we're responsible for. We import a lot of stuff. The carbon content of the stuff we import isn't counted. So I think we really need to start measuring what we're doing, because if the goal is, and I think the goal has to be, to export knowledge, to export innovation, if we are getting to a lower carbon count in ways that are either just moving the carbon across the border because we now import the finished products instead, or are not really as effective as they're claimed to be, the rest of the world isn't going to buy into it. So I think we really need to maximize credibility. And one of the things that I have been arguing for recently is that means doing much more thorough evaluation, independent evaluation, by independent agencies. So the agency that is responsible for reaching these goals shouldn't also be the agency that's actually doing the accounting, because they have a reason to say, yeah, we reached the goals. And I think we need to really invest in that as well. At the same time, we're doing a lot of innovation. We are pushing ourselves. And I think that California is going to be a leader. We do have to keep in mind that, as Dan said, we're 1% of global greenhouse gas emissions. The goal here is to reduce world greenhouse gas emissions. And so everything we do has to be channeled through that. It has to be focused on, is this something the rest of the world is likely to adopt? So either if it's expensive, we only do it because while it's expensive, it might push costs down. If we just say we have to get to number X to show that we can, I think that's actually shooting ourselves in the foot, because we end up doing things that are sort of short run, expensive fixes that really aren't exportable. So everything should really be put to that. Is it exportable? And can it plausibly get to cost effective?
One of the policy experiments that's caught the attention of the world and the technology marketplace is our work in energy storage. Picking up on an audience question here about the pace of change in energy storage, California's approach to driving that innovation, does it seem to be on the right track? Is it an exportable model? And will it arrive cost-effectively to solve some of the problems we're creating on the grid, the famous duck curve, which one of you might describe as a singular expression of the pending imbalance in our energy system from relying on renewables?
So the duck curve, for those of you who aren't aware of it, is I'm not going to be able to draw it here for you. There is a total demand for electricity in California, and then after you take out solar production, you get a net demand, net of solar, and it turns out particularly in the fall and spring, you get a very low net demand in the middle of the afternoon because all of that solar is producing. And by the way, this is not the stuff on your rooftop. That's a very small piece of it. Most of it is the big solar farms. But the problem is that, of course, as you do that, solar becomes less and less valuable. Because now you're producing solar when you already had a lot of solar. So one of the aspects that we have to deal with is how are we going to actually move the solar power to a place where we are time when we can really use it the most. I'm sorry.
Is storage
battery? Oh, right. Solution, so right.
How
so,
is California's approach to promoting energy storage shaping up to be the solution or part of that solution?
I'm going to let Hal be the technology prognosticator because I certainly wouldn't claim to know. I sure hope so. People say, look at solar, it came way down in cost. Look, storage is on the same path. But the problem is there are a lot of other technologies that were on that same path for a while and then stalled out. So biofuels were once on a steep cost reduction path and they sort of stalled out. And there's no shortage of failures. I hope batteries or storage is on that path too, but I think all we can do is invest and hope and do the best we can and be smart about the investments.
Batteries are very tough. Electrochemistry is unforgiving. So the good news is the progress on cost has been spectacular. I mean, halving the cost of batteries in the last 2.5 years or so. I don't think that's going to stop. The progress on other characteristics of batteries, namely their bulk, their mass, the amount of physical stuff you have to put in the car, say, to contain a given amount of energy, has not progressed nearly as quickly. I think batteries will continue to innovate quickly. I also think cheap, light batteries would be fantastic, but we do not need cheap, light batteries to manage this transition. They will help, and they will get cheaper. But this idea you have to wait until the miracle arrives is the wrong idea. There are many alternative strategies that can get you there. I of course cross my fingers and would push public policy to accelerate that. But it's not a wait for miracles thing.
In the realm of constructive engagement with the current political moment, this is an interesting question from the audience. What infrastructure projects would you recommend to the president?
Transmission. Back to my previous comment that we are going to need a nationally integrated grid. I will note that if you actually read what was on President Trump's website, it was actually a public-private partnership through tax credits that, at least my take as an economist, is likely to have almost no incremental investment value. But if we really wanted to do something that would be a major public works project that it would have huge payoff in the long run, it would be transmission. And I would love to see that happen, but I'm not that optimistic.
If they give block grants for infrastructure, then we could use it for transmission, we could use it for EV charging, we could use it for bike paths, we could use it for transit, we could use it for a suite of long-term investments to build the infrastructure that the future economy needs. If we run it through the committees, I mean, it's a states' rights question in a way, right? If we run it through the committees in the House and they put a bunch of boxes around it and we can only use it to add lanes to freeways, skip.
Mm-hmm. Actually, one point is, this is one place actually where we need the federal government because interstate transmission. One of the problems, actually, states' rights has held up interstate transmission lines because there's always some state that doesn't get enough value or feels that they don't, that blocks it. And at some point, if we're going to get a national transmission system, which in the long run we would think of as our national highway system, as creating tremendous value, but at some point somebody's going to be made unhappy in the process.
So incorporating these themes and any that I've failed to raise, which I'm sure there were a lot, tell us an optimistic story about where we're going to be January 2020. What will we have achieved? What would remain to be done? What will be the lessons from California? And where will the international community be on the subject of climate change?
I'll go first. I think California is going to continue to push forward with renewable energy and with integration into the grid and with demand response technologies that allow you to integrate renewables in the grid. I hope we're going to invest more in the basic research and science we need to move that forward and ramp up our investment in the evaluation and testing. And if we do that, I think 4 years from now, we will be ready, and maybe sooner than 4 years from now when there's a shift on this, which will depend in some to some extent on climate events. We had the hottest 2016 after the hottest year of 2015, and we're already on a very hot 2017. At some point, even the naysayers are going to have to say, boy, something strange is going on. And maybe we will see a reversal at that point, and California will be ready, having stepped ahead and made these investments.
So nobody in America will contemplate building a coal-fired power plant anymore. And they're getting shut down at record rates. Maybe we'll have another 40 of them shut down by then. The California grid will be 50% decarbonized. And this is a real prediction, right? 35% renewable energy and the balance hydro and existing nuclear. So we'll be half off on carbon in the grid. That doesn't deal with transportation enough. I think we can start looking at numbers like 1 out of 10 new cars are electric. I don't think that's aggressive. It's 1 out of 3 already in Norway. Norway's a little more enlightened, but also a little more cold than California. So for me, it's beginning to not just define the vision of the future, but to see it becoming economically achievable and giving people the texture, the taste, and the touch of it, so it's not abstract. When we're there, 3 years is a very short amount of time in the energy world. The power plants, the average age of a coal-fired power plant in America is 43 years right now. And the nuclear power plants in this country were built in the 70s, essentially, right? So the energy technology has multi-decadal time arcs. 3 years, we'll get a lot done, but we're not going to get it all done.
Well, we'll meet you back here for the next conversation. That's all the time we have for tonight. On behalf of World Affairs, I ask you to join me in thanking Hal Harvey and Severin Bornstein for this excellent discussion.
And Dan Adler.
Any thanks to you all?
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a membership organization dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Severin Bornstein, who's professor of business administration and public policy at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. You also heard from Hal Harvey, CEO of Energy Innovation, Policy and Technology. They were in conversation with Dan Adler, Vice President of Policy at the Energy Foundation. This broadcast is made possible by the generous support of Chevron. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.